let's start with the goal of these training sessions. I sat through today. It was very interesting, a lot of lively questioning. What's the idea here? You've had the book, you've had the movie. Why do you need this?
Well, the whole purpose is to try to get the scientific facts about the climate crisis presented to as many people as possible so that public opinion will be informed by the reality of our situation. The political system has been paralyzed by the climate crisis. It's partly because CO2 is the principal global warming pollution, is woven into the fabric of industrial civilization. And even though if we set our minds to it, we can prosper and improve the economy by reducing waste and pollution, it requires overcoming inertia. And the political leadership has, in both parties, more so in the other party for me, I want to give some credit to the fact that the Democratic Party has been a little better on it, but not that much better. And overall, there hasn't been the impetus for change. And I've come to believe that the only way we can bring about the change that's so essential to save the climate balance that's essential for civilization is to change enough minds and persuade enough people at the grassroots level in both political parties, in all political persuasions, to make it an issue that's not political but moral, because it is. It affects the survival of our civilization. And that means spreading the message far and wide at the grassroots level. And there are, thankfully, a lot of people who agree with me on this and have enough passion to come and spend a lot of time here in Nashville learning about the facts from these scientists and from the in-depth discussions, how to give this slideshow. I'm giving them my slides so they can present them in their voices, connect them to their own passion for trying to save the global environment. And boy, it's inspiring to me to see and feel and hear the way they are taking to this task. And the first two classes that I trained have already collectively given my slideshow more times as a group than I've been able to give it personally in 15 years. So that's great.
Well, that's just the power of numbers there. When people hear these presentations, the folks you train, they go out to the Kiwanis Club or their schools, wherever they're going to give this. What is it that you want the people who get this message to do? What's more important, the personal consumption choices about energy or the political choices that they might make based on, say, a candidate or a platform that addresses this issue?
Well, I don't think they're separate. When people when they see the reality of it and reach a conclusion that this is a moral issue and we have to change, first of all, they want to make changes in their own relationship to the problem. They want to become part of the solution instead of part of the problem. Lots of people are becoming what's called carbon neutral. They're reducing their CO2 and then purchasing or planting trees and in other ways creating offsets for the rest. But when people take personal actions, that leads inevitably to their desire to have changes in policies. And no matter what political party they're in, they begin to communicate with their representatives at the local and state and national level and say, look, I've made these changes in my life. I understand this. Here are some facts you may not know. If you don't, you know, I want you to work for changes in policy. And I think that they're linked together.
Yeah, because I know at the end of the film, for example, when the credits were rolling, there are all these things you can do, which kind of gave it a uplifting spirit at the end. But I was wondering, you know, okay, I can drive a hybrid car, mass transit, use fluorescent bulbs instead of incandescent bulbs, et cetera, et cetera. What difference does it make if China is still going to build a coal-fired power plant a week?
Well, the world as a whole must respond to this and will respond to it, but it's more likely to respond more quickly when the U.S. provides leadership and when enough American citizens become part of this new critical mass of opinion and the U.S. changes policy, then it becomes much more likely that China will make the changes it has to make. They understand in China. I've been there many times on this issue, talked with their leaders, talked with their scientists, talked with their business people. It's a misconception to think that they're oblivious to this and bound and determined not to be a part of the solution. Just this past week, there was a major statement in China about the dangers China faces from global warming. They've made the environment a co-equal goal with the economy in their official policy. They have some standards that are higher and better than ours. Now, there are a lot of things they're doing wrong, and I certainly accept the premise of your question. They need to change. But the best way to bring that change is to provide the leadership we can provide, and then work with those in China who fully understand the necessity for them to change, and we're all in this together.
We just had a shift of power in Congress, and I heard Senator Reid, the new majority leader in the Senate, and the new Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, give their first speeches to their respective chambers. Both of them emphasized a need for action on climate change. Do you think that Democrats, your party being in control of Congress, will necessarily translate into some meaningful action on this topic?
Well, I hope so. And both Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi are personal friends and have been political allies. I'm a recovering politician myself, as I say it. But I have supported them and worked with them, and I'm optimistic. But I have to say, as I have said to these folks here today privately, this really shouldn't be approached as a political issue. It has political dimensions. Some of the solutions require action within the political system. But ultimately, it's a moral issue. It's an ethical issue. It's almost a spiritual issue because it affects our survival. Who are we? What is our moral responsibility to those who come after us? And since the consequences of global warming are already now becoming evident in our lifetimes, it is a little easier to see why the need to act is on us right now. And it used to be that the environment was a bipartisan issue, and it can be again. Conservatives, liberals, Democrats, Republicans, we all have the same stake in this. And the issue of how we solve it, how we can most effectively address it, we should debate that and talk about it. But what should change is the efforts of some who are intentionally trying to delay any reasoned debate by confusing the scientific evidence with by putting out smoke screens and sort of pseudo-scientific studies. If we can bring enough people to see the real scientific facts and then to encourage political leaders of every persuasion to act, I think we have a real good chance of having a dramatic change fairly soon.
Do you think the American people are there yet in understanding the kind of consensus that exists in the scientific community on climate change, or do you still have work to do in that direction? And do you think the American people are ready to support a candidate for a president or other office who, makes that a top item on their platform?
Well, I think that there have been some changes in public opinion. I think that much more work needs to be done, not only on the narrow question of people's opinions, but more importantly on the sense of urgency that they bring to the task of addressing the climate crisis. And as for your question about a candidate, I want to see the creation of a new political reality in America where the candidates in both political parties are competing among themselves to carry that mantle and to offer genuinely effective solutions. For my own part, as you know, I don't have any intentions of ever being a candidate again. But I am involved in a different kind of campaign. It's a campaign to persuade enough people, to change enough minds, to bring our country across a kind of political tipping point beyond which the majority of politicians in every party and persuasion are really competing to offer the best solutions that will solve the problem most quickly. That's really the change that's needed. Not a single candidacy, not a single speech, not a single proposal. The essence of the challenge before us is that the maximum conceivable change right now still is far short of the minimum that would actually solve the problem. So the challenge is not one that's easily remedied by a candidacy or a campaign. It really requires a sea change in public attitudes. And the good news is that's beginning to take place. We do have lots more work to do, but there are a lot of people who are putting their shoulders to that wheel. The wheel's beginning to turn.
If I'm a politician listening to you saying this, I might say, well, why didn't he do more when he was in office? If this was such a passionate issue for him, he had 8 years as vice president, what did he accomplish on climate change?
Well, it's a fair question, and there's a difference between trying to do something, making your best efforts continually, and meeting obstacles that are very difficult to overcome. I tried my best, and I learned in the process that the opposition to the kind of dramatic changes that are needed is so deep and so ingrained that it may well be that the only way to bring about the kind of policy changes that are needed is to first of all bring about the changes in public opinion that make it possible for political leaders in both parties to do what's necessary. I'll give you an example, a couple of examples. I proposed a carbon tax of sorts, and we got it passed in one House of Congress, but the other balked. And then it became a political issue in the first midterm election. And it was a learning experience. It wasn't daunting. I went back and tried again. But a second example, I went to Kyoto and helped to bring about the breakthrough that achieved the treaty there. And it's been adopted by virtually every nation in the world. But as vice president, when I brought that treaty back home to the United States, I could only convince one senator out of 100 to ratify it, the late Paul Wellstone. And it's not that the other senators didn't care or weren't intelligent, none of that. It's just that they looked at the state of opinion in their constituencies, in their home states, and what they found was a situation where they felt that it was sort of beyond the pale, beyond the possibility to imagine supporting something like that without suffering real electoral consequences. So one of the things I learned from that experience had to do with the need to go to the grassroots level and change public opinion to the maximum extent possible. And all these 1,000 volunteers who are taking the time to come here to Nashville for days on end to learn the slideshow, to learn the inner workings of it, to learn the nuances of the science, to learn presentation skills, to learn how to go out and help to spread these messages and these facts. That's part of a larger effort to bring about this sea change in public opinion quickly enough to support changes in policy, changes in behavior, changes in business practices. And the good news, again, is that these changes are beginning to take place. I hope they'll be speeded up and take place in time. I believe that they will.
Can you quickly handicap what we know about the likely candidates for president in 08 and who you think would do the best job on this?
Well, I don't think I'm very good at that.
Well, let me rephrase it slightly. If I'm a voter and this is a high-level issue for me, what should I be looking for specifically in a candidate other than just some blanket statement, oh, we should do something about that?
Well, let the candidates of your party know that this is the most important issue to you, and demand responses that are substantive and proposals that are meaningful, and become a part of this growing movement to build a critical mass of support for American leadership to solve the climate crisis.
And when we talk about action on climate change, there are a number of people who are saying the crisis is so great that we need all available options for energy that don't put out a lot of carbon, and that includes nuclear power. James Lovelock, one of the creators of the Gaia hypothesis, wrote a book about this recently. What do you think? Do we need to at least reassess nuclear power as a possible tool to combat climate change?
Well, I am not an absolutist. I'm not a reflexive opponent of nuclear power. But I am skeptical that it's going to play more than a relatively small role, and there are reasons for that. Here in the Tennessee Valley, we went through an experience 30 years ago when TVA had almost 20 nuclear power plants under construction. Virtually all of them had to be canceled because rising energy prices led to conservation, and they recalculated their projections. And nuclear power plants in the present generation come in only one size, extra large. And they're very expensive. They take a long time to build. And even with the slight increase in political enthusiasm for the technology, the utility executives are still very reluctant. And the ratepayers have had some unpleasant experiences in higher rates with canceled plants that never got finished. The problems with waste disposal and the danger of reactor error, let's assume both of those things can be solved. This problem of economics is still looming large, and the growing attractiveness of the economics of renewable sources of energy stand in sharp contrast. Now, the problems of a worldwide policy to promote nuclear power also involve the dangers of proliferation of nuclear weapons, and that's not an issue that'll go away easily. But, you know, if these problems can be successfully addressed, including the economic issue, then I'm not a reflexive opponent, but I do think we need to be realistic about this. And where subsidies are concerned, I really think that the renewable energy sources, particularly these new conservation and efficiency options that take advantage of the new computing power and the new ways of redesigning systems to make them so much more efficient. That may not sound like a lot of, it has a lot of sex appeal, but actually, in practical terms and economic terms, those things are turning out to be much more attractive, much more efficient, much more profitable for people than making these huge mega-billion-dollar investments in technologies that take many years to build and then are fraught with the uncertainty and high expense.
I know you have made it clear that you're not running for office now and you don't appear to have those intentions, but I took an informal poll of your trainees here, and they seem to think you should run for president. Have you ruled that out completely?
Well, it's nice when somebody says that they think that about me, and I do appreciate that. But I do not have any plans or intentions or expectations of it. And the small exception of saying, no, I'm not going to make some Sherman statement, should not be interpreted by anyone as an effort to leave the door open or to say I'm being coy about this. I'm really not. I've fallen out of love with politics. I'm not hungering to ever be a candidate again, and really do not anticipate any circumstances in which I would be. But again, I'm involved in a different kind of campaign. It's an effort to try to persuade people about why and how we must rise to the challenge of confronting and successfully solving the most serious challenge our civilizations ever faced. And It feels very fulfilling for me to be deeply involved and expending all of my energies in trying to get people to change their minds on this. And that's the focus of my efforts.